perfectly doable even with software. The big question is, you know, how would you like to control that? Because there's all kinds of different buttons that run on USB, some cheaper than others, that can actuate software and change settings of virtual audio devices.
Key thing here is that I would like to do it from the rig side, so what I had to do was use a switch, an audio switch, which plugs into the headphones jack and then separates it out between the headphones and the external speaker. However, the output from the headphones jack is not as much than the external speaker jack. So is there a way to amplify simply with some small component or add-on the signal from the microphone jack to the external speaker?
In a word, yes. You know, in the old days, you'd pull out an old popular electronics and, you know, a couple of bipolar transistors and a couple of resistors and a capacitor or two, and you would whip it up. Nowadays, probably it would be cheaper to just get a little board from Amazon, you know, an amplifier that... That took the easiest voltage that you could find, you know, around your shack, you know, 12 volts if you're just getting it directly from the power supply, or 9 volts if you want to use a transistor radio battery or what have you. So I would kind of go through Amazon and see if something. I'm sure there's loads of different Chinese little modules that would work the way that you want them to, where they have good isolation and a nice little simple volume knob on the side to tweak it to the amplification that suits you for your bigger, heavier speaker enclosure.
Exactly. I'll look into that, because all it is a mono line out. So it shouldn't be rocket science.
No, it should be simple. I mean, there might be some little gotchas if you don't know what you're doing, but it's not a complicated. It's probably the most simple circuitry that you, short of a light bulb lighting up, that people have fiddled around with. But again, you know, in the old days, it was more cost-effective to put it together yourself, get a PC board, do a little soldering. Nowadays, probably for $6, you can get a complete amplifier module with its own little enclosure.
Okay, thanks. I'll look into it.
You're welcome. Well, I hate to repeat myself, but as for the last 5 times I said it, the night is still young. So if anyone has any topics for discussion or questions, or someone realized something amazing about science and technology and wants to share it with us, please hit that push to talk.
Call out K2CJE.
Yes, Ed.
I think he said the output to the speaker is at a higher level, so why don't you just plug in there and with a little aluminum box have an output switch that goes to the speaker and a jack for the headphones, but just reduce the volume to the headphones and then should level it all out over. Keep it simple.
Okay, yeah, that certainly is simple. The big question I have for Brian is, if can you crank it up so that the speaker output is acceptable to you, or is it always just too low in the volume?
Well, actually, this is a converse. It comes out of the microphone jack, okay, and powers the microphone very nicely, but does not have enough output to power the external speaker. So when I advance the AF control, it does get louder, but not as loud and as powerful enough as if it would be if I plugged it into the external speaker jack. So I think you're talking about maybe, less than a watt versus 2.5 watts output on the external speaker.
Well, is there any way to tap the power that's supposed to go into the speaker itself and branch that off to the headphone with a voltage lowering resistor?
Oh, okay. I understand what you're saying. I would need to know what value in order to put that in so as to not overload the headphones.
Just use the pot and adjust it.
Yes, but what value pot?
Put in a 1 megohm pot for the source and put the headphone between the ground and the arm on the pot and adjust it so it's suitable. Over.
Okay, good idea. Thank you. I'll go ahead and try that. I'll wire that up.
Okay, thank you very much, Ed.
WB2BX.
Yes, Frank?
Yeah, very good. And I also have another question you may know something about. What I did, and it's years ago now, but what I used to do in my old station, which I think worked with my ICOM 765, and I think it worked with my TS-820. I realize those are ancient radios now. I would push the headphone jack in about three-quarters of the way so that I guess the head and the ring, and I may not be using the right terminology for the phone jack, both made contact, but at the same time, it didn't shut off the speaker. So I was able to listen through both the speaker and the headphones at the same time, and I think that's what you're trying to do. And I do not know if that would still work with some of the newer radios because, they may be doing this with some logic rather than with fairly simple electronics. Go ahead, Roy.
Yeah, I think we kind of chatted about that earlier. I tend to think that it's still a mechanical switch for the sake of the jack. It's just relatively so cheap to buy that electrical engineers have kind of restrained themselves from showing how clever they are by having the CPU sense how it is. I would assume that has a lot to do, though, with the manufacturer of the jacks and the age of the jacks and how flexible, and if there's corrosion, there might be a pressure point that holds, that allows that, but I wouldn't kind of expect that to be a universal way of getting around things. So if it works for you, great, but I don't know what percentage of the population trying to do that would work. That's not exactly apparently what Brian is looking for. He's looking more for a switch to go from one sound output to another sound output, from the headphones to a speaker, and keeping it the same sound level.
Oh, I get it. Yeah. I know it's also fairly easy. I've seen it at Field Day, and maybe at some contest stations where you plug into a box. You can plug in multiple headphones, so both the operator and the logger could both hear the radio. But I don't know if that can be done with, but because the impedances are different, I don't know that you can do that with a local speaker and the headphones. I never tried that. The trick I described, I think, works with all three of my HF radios at my old station, but, you know, it's hard to believe, but we're talking about no more recent than almost 20 years ago now, so that my recollection may not be exactly correct, or it may not work anymore with the newer radios. May I ask another question while, before you move on, Roy?
Sure, Frank.
Okay. Yeah, maybe you know this. Interesting question. My wife came up with an interesting question related in part to social media. Is that X, the website formerly known as Twitter, sort of like the artist formerly known as Prince, I guess, now shows the country of Oregon. Origin of the tweets or posts or whatever they call them this week. But as we know, the country of origin can easily be faked by using a VPN. But my wife was trying to figure out how she can get a hint of whether the country of origin is being faked or whether you just can't tell whether the user is coming through a VPN or not. Some of the accounts, some of the posts say they're coming through the web, some say they're coming through the app. And she asked me, is that a hint? If you're coming through would a VPN disguise whether you're coming through a smartphone app or coming through the web, or would that vary by how sophisticated the VPN is? Do you have any idea, Roy? Maybe somebody else here does. Go ahead.
Well, as we mentioned somewhat last week, there's a reasonably good way of detecting whether you're operating on a VPN, and a lot of big commercial companies hire other companies to throw you off if you're using a VPN. And it's very simple. Every VPN has a license utilization for their IP addresses. They buy a bunch of incremental and non-incremental IP addresses. Those IP addresses are made public. And so if a database simply holds on to the IP addresses of VPNs and you were detected using one of their IP addresses, you're labeled as using a VPN and you're kicked off of their servers. So it's relatively simple if you're so inclined. I don't know whether X is inclined or not. I think we talked about this before, that I'm not 100% sure that whatever they're using to sniff IP addresses are 100% legit, because a couple of weeks ago they were getting the defense IP addresses that were located in Israel. And I don't think the Defense Department of the United States has offices in Israel. So there's something a little screwy about their lookup tables and such.
Actually, I think there are there is a Defense Department detachment in Israel now, I believe, working on the alleged Gaza peace agreement, because I think there are some elements of it that the U.S. is supposed to guarantee, but maybe that was months ago and maybe that's changed. So there may very well be, as well as, of course, the defense attaché at the embassy, but that's a very small number. But, yeah, I think there may, in fact, be Defense Department detachment of some sort in Israel. So I don't know whether that's correct or not. But obviously the companies, I would guess the gambling companies are probably maybe doing that to try to protect themselves from people who are in states that don't allow online gambling, because the obvious workaround to that is to come into the gambling site through a VPN in a gambling-friendly state. So I would guess they're doing it. But if you're the ordinary user looking at where users are coming from on X, can you tell without getting a service that recognizes the VPN and tells you whether the VPN is not the VPN and tells you whether the IP address is coming through a VPN or not? So go ahead.
Yeah, as far as I'm aware, the primary way is to have a lookup table with registered IP addresses that are already licensed to VPNs. And by the way, gambling joints love VPNs because it gives them an excuse. But it wasn't their fault. They legitimately recognized the user as out of country because of their IP address. And, poor little me, we can't afford VPN protection. Detection. So the gambling places love VPNs and love people violating the rules with VPNs. The companies that don't are the companies that actually make more money by reinforcing those rules. Like I have YouTube TV, and if I use a VPN, so that would kind of give me access to out of country. Channels, they'll lock me down. So those people take it legitimate. But gambling joints would probably send me a bottle of wine if I used the VPN on their site.
Yeah, I always assume that's why VPNs are being so widely advertised now, is because people are using them to go to the gambling joints. And then it occurred to me that, well, maybe some of them don't want to have problems with state regulators, would lock them out. Yeah, I have YouTube TV also. I never really thought of doing that, but that's an interesting point, is that they won't let you get out of country content that way. I've never tried that, but that's good to know. Go ahead.
Roger, Roger, late check-in. This is KT2 QYW. Joe from Harrison, New York.
Hello, Joe. You got a question or a subject for us tonight, or are you just checking in?
Roger, Roger. I'm just checking in, and I'll be on the side listening. Yeah, it's been a long time, and thank you for recognizing me and remembering me. This is KT2 QYW. Joe will be listening.
Yes, indeed, Joe. I remember you well, and you've been missed. Thanks for coming back to us. Anyway, getting back to you, Frank, I remember years ago that VPNs, one of the things that VPNs promoted as a reason for buying their services was for things like Netflix or other streaming services that were locked down geographically. So you could, go on there and say you're English, and all of a sudden you have access to all the BBC and the other British broadcasters that you wouldn't normally have. But most of those guys have locked these things down, and I doubt that it's going to change much in the short term. Right now, VPNs are being promoted as a way of regaining some of your privacy so that, services can't kind of sniff you out. Unfortunately, that's a two-edged sword. It's not as secure as a lot of the companies would suggest. especially torrents, which aren't as popular as they used to be, but they're still somewhat popular. You know, people have the idea that if you borrow stuff using torrents, using a VPN, you're undetectable. But unfortunately, VPNs have been known to be leaky. And so, and there are more than a few technologies out there where servers kind of sniff torrent sites and look for leaking IP addresses, and then you get a notice from your internet service provider that, you know, if we find you doing this again, we're going to shut off your service. So, you know, to give away the fact that the VPNs do not completely hide you. If you start to use multiple levels of proxies, you get a little bit more security and privacy, but it becomes a cat and a mouse game. One side is always trying to outwit the other, and it doesn't stay stable for very long.
Yeah, that's what I figured. I mean, I would occasionally used a VPN for a couple of things. But, yeah, I actually haven't used it in a long time. I do subscribe to one, an expensive one, though, and I know there are a lot of free ones, but I remember when I checked into it a few years ago, another ham with a lot of sophistication in this area told me get one of the paid ones, they're better. Anyway, those were my, that's my 2 cents. Let me go on with the next, WB2BXL.
Okay, very good, Frank.
Okay,
thank you as always.
Frank, thank you as always.
There seems to be a loop going on. I don't know if someone is feeding back the signal or what. Let's try again. Okay, that's much better. I don't know what was causing that. I use VPNs almost every day, but for a very strange reason. I've mentioned before that I have a couple of Echolink applications running simultaneously. And if you want to really upset up Echolink, they don't mind particularly that you're running multiple applications. They do mind if those applications are using the same IP address, and the IP address is gotten from the internet service provider. Usually when you get a service, they assign you either a dynamic IP address or a static IP address, and it's usually just one address. They don't give you a range of addresses. So when I'm running my two Echolinks on my two computers, and one of them and both of them are listed as having the same IP address, I get a nasty letter from Echolink. If I put one behind a virtual private network, a VPN, it issues an IP address that the VPN owns rather than my own. So one is mine and the other one is the VPN company, and Echolink is more than happy to keep on chugging. So I use that regularly. I don't use VPNs to kind of hide behind things mostly because it doesn't really work well. But there's a lot of good uses for VPNs, but unfortunately the advertisements are incredibly optimistic and misleading. But that's the way that most ads on the Internet are. Anyway, once again, I'm AC2GS, and this is the Limark Technical Net. And if anyone has any questions or comments or topics for tonight, please feel free to hit that push to talk.
One follow-up question on what you were talking about. Are you... You're logging in from two different IP addresses, but with the same call sign, or are you using the club call as your Echolink login on the VPN addresses? Because they're still seeing the same call sign, they're just seeing it from two IP addresses, and they'll accept that. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, it's two different call signs because I'm the Echolink node for my other club, the Kings County Radio Club. So one of the Echolink applications is listed as KC2RC dash R, and the other one is AC2GS. So they're different accounts. But again, even if they're different accounts, if they're both coming from the same IP address, Echo Link detects that and sends you a nasty email.
Okay, I didn't know they were that sophisticated, but okay. Yeah, that's interesting. So you can't, they won't let you on with the same call sign, so I couldn't come in with WB2BXO from my desktop and WB2BX and use the VPN on my desktop and then WB2BXO for my phone going directly through through my internet provider, through Verizon. Am I understanding that?
Yeah, that's my understanding. I would assume the Echo Link servers send a message to the systems administrator, and he ends up sending a nasty letter back. So it checks the IP address, and I think it also checks the account and call sign. You'd be surprised at all the different applications that identify people's IP address. Earlier tonight, I mentioned that I offer an audio stream of this technical net, and I usually, when I'm doing the tech net, I have that window up on my computer, and I can see the IP addresses that are connected to different people who are listening to the audio stream. And in some cases, it's more than one. Some people are listening on two devices for whatever reason. I don't know. One maybe is a computer, and the other one is a cell phone. And I have the list of IP addresses up on the screen throughout the entire technical net. So IP addresses are very easy to sniff. And if you want to scare yourself, get some kind of software that sniffs the packets that try and access your ports from the internet. And there's an endless number of them, just kind of robots that keep on banging against the window trying to gain access, an open port or something that they could then use to secure all the information on your computer. It's the Wild West out there.
Does Windows 11 have a built-in virus detector or firewall, or do I really have to make sure I have McAfee or Norton or one of those guys running? Go ahead.
Theoretically, yes, they have a firewall, they have an antivirus. I don't think it's terribly good. I haven't heard anyone really compliment it. I've kind of gone through all kinds of antivirus software. What usually happens is the manufacturer starts to lose customers, and instead of making it a good product, they simply add stuff that slows it down more and more and more until it's sluggish as anything. And then everyone leaves, and then they announce that they're going to rewrite the code and make it real tight and sparse, and so it'll operate quickly and it won't include features that no one wants. Right now, this year, I'm using WebRoot. I really do like WebRoot, but again, all these, once upon a time, most of these antivirus softwares were good. It changes over time because of market demands and greed, unfortunately.
Yeah, okay, yeah. I have McAfee on one of my computers, and I've retired the computer at least temporarily until I can get somebody to reinstall Windows and see if it runs better. It just got bogged down and essentially stopped running. Which was disappointing because I really liked the way that machine was set up. In any case, Ed McAfee on that computer, but not on this computer, and it looks as if that McAfee will now protect multiple devices, so I should be able to log in on this computer and use my current McAfee account. The thing is, of course, I have to find my username and password. I tried logging in with Google, and that doesn't seem to work because I probably used a different email when I set up the McAfee account. Anyway, that's kind of annoying. So for the time being, I'm just running with on this machine with whatever Windows 11 is running. Anyway, thanks a lot for all the suggestions, Roy. And back to that, BB2BXL.
You're welcome, Frank. And as far as the McAfee, usually I don't know them specifically, and they change over time, but usually if you say that you forgot your password, they won't just say that they're going to send it to an arbitrary email they have listed for you. They will put some asterisks in it so that the visible letters will give you a reasonable clue of which email account that you had it listed for. So if you can figure it out and it's still active, you can go to that email account and collect the link to change your password.
Do that without a problem. All right, I'll probably do that during the week because it's kind of annoying that I'm paying for the service and it's not on the computer, as far as I know, that I'm actively using. Thanks again, Roy. WB2BX.
You're welcome, Frank. Once again, I'm AC2GS. I think I heard someone out there double with Frank earlier. If you got a question or a comment or a topic, hit that push to talk. Okay, maybe I was mistaken. Again, Phil, we do have time. So if anyone has any kind of topic for discussion, please feel free at that push to talk. Okay, I guess it's one of those nights. The chat room is completely empty. It's hasn't been very busy lately, but it's kind of unusual to be completely empty. Occasionally people kind of wander in and wander out or something, but it's just I'm just the only one listed on it. So maybe it's just an early night. I don't know. It's up to you guys. We could make it an early night and move on to the SpaceNet report, or again, unless someone has a question or a comment or a topic for discussion, we can roll that around for a while. So again, I throw it into the ball into your court. If you got any kind of question or comment or topic, hit that push to talk and let me have it.
Okay, N1YDY with a computer question.
Sure, we do computers.
Okay, I've got a desktop unit, not a laptop, that has Windows 10 on it, and I'm wondering if, since it's no longer supported, if I need to replace the unit or I can actually get 11 to work onto it.
It sort of depends upon Microsoft and their weirdness. You remember there was a talk of a security chip 2.0, and if your motherboard had that security chip, you could upgrade to 11, but if you didn't have that security chip, it wouldn't allow it. You remember that conversation on the Internet?
I do. And one of the reasons I never upgraded is I had no clue whether or not my machine had it, had an Acer.
The brand doesn't particularly matter. It's more of when it was built. Because if you have something that was built after, I think, about 2014, chances are it has a security chip 2.0. Probably the easiest way is to just kind of try to upgrade it and see how your computer takes it. If he doesn't, you know, back everything up so that you don't lose anything. I would just go to their site and look into upgrading from 10 to 11. run the software, and if you're real lucky, it'll take and upgrade it, and if it doesn't, then you have your answer.
Comment?
Sure, Brian.
Upgrading from Windows 10 to 11 on semi-legacy hardware is really, really easy. All you need to do is download a program called Flyby11. And what it does is that basically takes the operating system and turns that check for the TPM module off. And it enables you to install Windows 11 just the way you want to without worrying about the trusted platform module.
Okay, Flyby 11. Thank you, Brian.
You are welcome. And there's a couple of other programs that do that, such as Rufus, R-U-F-U-S, because you have to build an ISO image on your computer and then boot from that. And either Rufus or Flyby 11 will do that for you very quickly and very easily.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Brian. I upgraded from 10 to 11 the old-fashioned way. You know, it just came up in the screen and said, would you like to upgrade to 11? And since I already knew that I had the TPM modules in there, I said yes. And there were a couple of hiccups through the years, but for the most part, I'm up to the latest, greatest version of Windows 11. I'm not impressed. There were things that Windows 10 did better, and unfortunately, there are things that Windows 7 did better. So just because it's a newer operating system, unfortunately, doesn't mean it's a more useful one. Most recently, Microsoft updated Office, and I lost a whole bunch of different features because of that. So I don't know what the hell they're doing in Microsoft's probably dreaming of an AI future, but they're certainly not really doing much with their software these days.
Windows 11 is basically, in my opinion, nothing but eye candy.
I wouldn't even go so far as to say it's eye candy. The taskbar was more useful and more attractive in 10.
Well, I don't use the start menu in Windows 10 or 11. I use a program called OpenShell, O-P-E-N space S-H-E-L-L. It's a free program that will bring normalcy back to the start menu and not cause you any grief at all, and it's totally free.
Yeah, I use Start 11, which is part of Object Desktop, which has a whole bunch of different applications. They charge, it's an annual subscription, but I like playing around with the different applications, so that's what I use, Start 11. But, you know, they all use the taskbar. It's not the, you can't really get around the taskbar.
Well, the taskbar could be customized to some extent, but it is what it is.
Yeah, unfortunately, you could have customized it more in 10 than you can 11.
It doesn't have any separators like Windows 10 had, for example.
Yeah, and also there are some things that you used to be able to right-click on the taskbar and do things that it's been taken out of it. It's, you know, I mean, I was able to kind of spread out the taskbar, I think, on all three of my monitors that my desktop uses at the same time. Now you really can't do that. It's, you know, you can duplicate it, which is useless, but you can't just kind of extend it from, you know, the main monitor to the side monitors and such. So, unfortunately, and a lot of people have complained to Microsoft that their new improved operating systems always seem to drop useful features. When I was using Office, I used the mail merge function. They took away the mail merge function. What was the point of that? That certainly isn't making anything better. It's making it worse. But, you know, this is unfortunately what Microsoft tends to do. They go into a huddle and they come out and they say, well, we're going to improve it by taking all these features out of the program. I don't understand. I accept that that's how big business tends to work. They're kind of like lunatics.
Why do you have to upgrade your Office copy?
Because I just want to make sure that new updated software isn't going to clash with it, and some software guy is going to tell me, well, it's really not designed for Windows 10, you know? You have to go with the latest, greatest, and we can't really look into it because you're using a discontinued operating system. So it's the path of least resistance. And as far as Office is concerned, they don't give you any option. You know, they sneak it in with the updates to the operating system. So I've never knowingly updated Office, and yet Office has been semi-crippled because of updates that are hidden in the weekly updates that they issue.
What Microsoft should do, and I felt this way for decades, is focus on making the best Windows possible and stop adding crazy, silly new features.
Yeah, but unfortunately, I don't think that's how programmers work. They come up with clever ideas that no one asked for. Even Apple does it. Liquid screen. I think most people kind of don't like it. It ranges from kind of don't like it to loathe and despise it. And yet, you know, with the beta versions, they kind of took some of it out, but they left a lot of it in. And again, programmers are an interesting group of people, but they don't really think like most of the rest of us.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about with the liquid glass on the iPhone, iOS. But, you know, I managed a group of programmers in project development, and I had to guide them very, very carefully because they... they had, you know, ideas, and, you know, they couldn't understand about, you know, the human factor and functionality.
Well, supposedly that's what Apple kind of prides themselves on knowing better than most programmers. The worst version of this phenomena, in my humble opinion, is Google. Google engineers love to write stuff. They write new applications, and then, you know, sometimes you actually get used to them, and then a year later they say, well, we're bored with this, so we're going to discontinue it effective December 31st. Lots of luck finding something that works like this. And then they throw something else against the wall, only to just kind of shut it down a year or two later for the heck of it. So, you know, I wish programmers were a little bit more foundational, you know, put a couple of ground rods around them and, you know, lock them down a little bit, because otherwise they just have flights of fancy and they just, isn't this cool, isn't that cool? But it's the same foolish mentality that gave us Elon Musk, you know, where the Cybertruck was cool. It had a lot of sharp edges that could kill people. It had terrible safety features, but it was cool. So I think the problem with programmers is that they are always looking for the next cool thing.
Well, KF2ZZ for station ID. There are programmers that I've worked with and know that are very logical, that understand the human factor and understand the way things should work without adding any extra bells and whistles to it to go ahead and throw people off. So, you know, it's a matter of opinion, and it depends on the group that you work with and the company mantra and all that stuff.
Yeah, but it just seems like the major software houses all have this affliction.
Well, they want to sell software, so obviously you have to throw in more bells and whistles and more bells and whistles and more bells and whistles until the product is basically unusable.
Well, again, that is usually what has happened in my experiences to antiviruses. You know, they're the extreme version of that. I kind of rotated through most of the antiviral companies over the 30 years that they existed because of that tendency to build in a Swiss Army knife of nonsense. And then eventually they get so heavy and they lose so many customers that they go back to the beginning where it was a real tight, well-written, you know, they had even some optimized machine language bits and pieces of it, and they got their customers back. But then they started to do the same thing over again. It seems to be a cyclical kind of phenomena among software, especially antivirus software manufacturers.
I'm using Norton 360 on my computer because basically before I retired, I did some QA work with Norton when it was owned by Symantec at that time. And they threw so many things in there. Software updater. Oh, my God. Like 10 different modules that I completely turned off because it was just bloat. Pure bloat.
Well, you can kind of tell when the end is coming. Now, like I said, my most recent antivirus is WebRoot, which I've got to. I owned the Norton at one time as well. And WebRoot is now promoting something that they call a system optimizer, which is the first sign that a software antivirus company is going to offer bloatware. What happens is, probably they'll offer the WebRoot security, which most people will not pay attention to, and then they'll decide that they've spent so much money developing it that they're going to just pack it into the WebRoot antivirus, whether people want it or not. So the bloat will increase the size of that memory that it takes up and slow down the antivirus. And then they'll lose more customers, and they'll add more features, not realizing that that's what got them into trouble in the first place. So I'm expecting WebRoot to go through the same cycle that all the other antiviruses have in my past.
The companies that produce the software, and Norton is no exclusion, with their system optimizer and everything else, first of all, anytime you hear the words system optimizer or registry optimizer, the first thing you want to do is stay away. I repeat, stay far away. And always make sure your computer is frequently backed up if you have to and know how to restore it. Because if you ever have a problem, that's the only way you're going to go ahead and get back.
Yeah, I agree with you entirely. I incrementally back up my computers every night, and I store them in multiple copies across the house. I got copies in the basement, copies on the first floor. I haven't gone obsessive-compulsive enough to put it in a safety deposit box and such, but I know people who do things like that. And I never really found cloud-based backup to be an efficient way of dealing with it. For whatever reason, it just never gave me any kind of good sense of speed. And I never really trusted cloud-based backups of, you know, terabytes of data and such. So, yeah, I'm a big fan of backup, and especially every so often, just for the hell of it, check to make sure that your backup software is able to actually restore something, because I've heard more than a few stories of guys who backed up every day, every night, and then when they actually needed that information, the restore function was built like garbage, and they couldn't actually get to anything. So check your backup software. Make sure that you can restore it without a severe migraine. You know, my software is very nice, but you have to basically boot it up on its MS-DOS in order to actually be able to restore all the partitions and such, which is a little annoying, but not enough to warrant me finding another company's backup solution.
Backing up in the cloud is extremely dangerous because you don't want to put your data on someone's, your own personal information on some server, no matter who owns it. I don't care if it's Google, Microsoft, it doesn't matter to me. Now, the best backup software for Windows is called Macrium Reflect. And I'll spell it Macrium Reflect. Okay, that's the software, Macrium Reflect. And you want to get Macrium Reflect Workstation, 64-bit. And it is the most reliable, it doesn't control your computer. It's a beautiful piece of software, both for backing up and also for restoring. Works like a charm.
Yeah, Macrium is what I use as well. Again, I would really like to be able to restore without going all the way down to the BIOS and booting off of a SD card. But you know, that's how life is.
Well, with Macrium, you can use just a flash drive, and it has a Linux-based OS on it. And basically, it has all your parameters that you set up. So once you go ahead and, you know, reboot, you hold your key down to get into the, you know, the select function. You select the device, and it boots up from there, and then you're good enough to go ahead and restore.
Again, it would be easier if I could just run a program, and it does the rebooting itself. And occasionally, when it boots up, it kind of misses the key press. So I've had more than a few times where I'm pressing the right key, and it just loads Windows because it didn't recognize that the key was pressed.
Just don't press it. Rapid tap it. Every tap, 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 tap. You know, keep going on and doing that until it detects.
Yeah, that's what I do, but it's not 100%. It's probably on a good day about 50-50.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Then the other way is just to hold it down steadily and see if that works. It's a BIOS thing. It's pulling the keyboard, and if it doesn't detect the keystroke, it'll just go ahead and bypass.
Yeah, but the BIOS is little fudgy with activating the accessories. So sometimes it powers it, sometimes it doesn't power it, sometimes it powers it and unpowers it. So again, it's not a sure thing. I have no solution to how do I 100% of the time boot up the BIOS rather than it going to Windows. Which again is a slight annoyance, not enough to go looking for yet another backup restore piece of software, because I kind of like this one. but enough to kind of groan if I have to go through that mess again.
Depends on what computer you have and what BIOS it is. You maybe want to check to see if there's a newer revision of the BIOS for your computer.
Yeah, I update my BIOS, although it's 7 years old. There's really not that much that they're going to change it for. So I think the last release BIOS was something like 3 or 4 years ago.
You might also want to look into your BIOS settings and see if there's any, auto detect, because there's a few things that you could look at and make sure the BIOS is set up properly. Or you could reset it back to factory defaults and see what that happens, you know, if that resolves the issue. All right.
Yeah, I've gone through all the permutations, unfortunately, and none of it really makes any difference. You could, of course, set it to boot up on the flash drive, but then you have to keep remembering not to plug those types of drives in unless you want it to boot up on those drives. So there's no simple solution. It's just one of the many annoyances that the modern computer age has given us. Anyway, I think this is my third backup and restore piece of software. I had two others prior to this. I switched over to this one about 2-3 years ago. Again, I guess so far so good. I mean, again, it's subject to change because, you know, nothing is the same. I mean, Reflect at least once a month, kind of hiccups and says, would you like to update the software? And I'm a glutton for punishment, so I say, yeah, sure.
Well, the new version right now is Macrium Reflect 10, or they also show it as Macrium Reflect Roman numeral X, because Macrium Reflect 8 is going to be discontinued. And honestly, it's a beautiful product. It really evolves so nicely, and it's so easy to do everything. And I have my whole computer, basically about 670 gigabytes with my two solid-state hard drives. Takes me about 20 minutes.
Well, yeah, it depends on what it's doing. I have it set to do a full backup once a month, and the rest of the month, every night, it's just a very quick incremental backup. That kind of suits me the best, you know. And I've had to occasionally do restores, and it works very nicely. Again, you got to jump through a hoop or two, but if you do that, then it's pretty much a simple operation. Again, I like it. It's not perfect, but it's very, very nice. So, you know, if you want perfect, lots of luck. Once again, this is still AC2GS, and this is still the Weimark Technical Net. I think I heard someone doubling with Brian during our conversation. If you're still out there and you have something you want to say, please hit that push to talk.
Are you guys on the repeater tonight?
Yeah, we're on the repeater tonight. Would you like to ID yourself, please? Okay, I guess that was semi-polite. No, thank you. Again, it's up to you guys. We do still have some free time if you got any questions or comments or topics to roll around. Otherwise, we'll move on to the next segment. But it's, I leave it up to you guys. If you If you sit there quietly and stare at the radio, then we'll move on. If you have a question or a comment or a topic, we'll address it as best we can. Well, yeah, that's what I pretty much am assuming, based on the aggressive response of the audience. So, thanks for participating. Please.